Hello, and welcome to Unfrozen. This is episode 71, and today, who is our guest, Greg?
Our guest is James Sanders. James is known for a lot of things, perhaps best known for his epic book, Celluloid Skyline, his study of New York in film. Also, of course, known for his work on New York, a documentary film that he wrote and produced with Rick Burns. You watched that on television. But James and I go way back to the 90s. In fact, we've worked on multiple projects together, including today's discussion about Renewing the Dream, a beautiful monograph, coffee table book by Rizzoli, looking at the transformation of mobility in Los Angeles. And this is where I get to toot my own horn, because I contributed a chapter at James' request on sort of the technology revolution in Southern California, one that continues to fall apart and lose parts by the day with the recent Chapter 11 bankruptcy by Bird. But there's many other smarter contributions, including Donald Shoup for you Shoupistas out here, Francis Anderton, and many more. We'll let James cover it. But the thing I like about it is that James also has invited me to work on multiple projects that are actually leading to changes in Los Angeles. James works with the Australian architecture firm Woods Bagot, which has done some interesting provocations about reimagining surface parking as new forms of architectural typologies, including the California Court, James's own contribution to reimagining housing types in LA, and then a project we worked on together about basically reimagining the Humble gas station at the behest of then LA Chief Design Officer Christopher Hawthorne. So, lots to get in here. Welcome, James, to the podcast.
Well, so nice to be here, and so good to see you, my old friend.
Well, it's good to have you. I guess the question we have to start with is how did a dyed-in-the-wool New Yorker and a team of Australian architects come to reimagine mobility in Southern California?
Well, that's a great question. I am a dyed-in-the-wool New Yorker, but as you point out, I did create a book called Celluloid Skyline, New York in the Movies, which was published in 2001 by Knopf. It took me over 10 or 12 years to write. And in that time, I spent a lot of time in California because as an architect, I wanted to really understand how movie sets and settings were created. So I found that I had to, and I speak specifically of Hollywood, so I found myself over, you know, sneaking into the studios and learning all about that. So I started spending quite a lot of time in Los Angeles and found myself sort of fascinated and mesmerized by the city, precisely because, in my view, it is the other great metropolis of America, that with all due respect to cities like Chicago and Philadelphia and Detroit, they're kind of smaller versions of the same essential morphology as New York, which is to say, you know, dense core, transit system, you know, concentrics, you know, et cetera. LA really is based on a different idea, a complex and sort of interwoven idea, but nonetheless a different one. And I found myself sort of fascinated by that city. Then I found myself as the Global Design Council consultant for Woods Bagot, which, although it did begin in Australia, is now a bona fide global firm. They have offices in 17 studios around the world, including all the major cities of Australia, Hong Kong, Shanghai, Beijing, San Francisco, New York, London, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, etc. They were interested in opening a new office in North America, and I just shared with them my fascination and excitement with Los Angeles, which they already had in mind. Obviously, it's the second largest market in North America, so it would be a good place to start a practice. And I suggested that rather than simply hanging out their shingle and competing with everybody else, that they enter the fray there by doing some serious thought leadership, to use that awful term, about the city and its future, and bring some of their extraordinary resources to bear, and specifically some of their data interpretation and gathering teams, which they, like many architecture firms, have nowadays, and do some really interesting work. And that's kind of where it all got started in 2018.
Well, very exciting. As someone who grew up in the Chicago area, lived in New York for 6 years, and then lived in LA for another 7 years, and now it's come back to Chicago, I've come full circle in my understanding of these cities and how they're arranged, and they all have their pros and cons. I think the biggest knock on LA is, of course, the relentless traffic and the traffic jams, and the way that everything has been funneled into just a few freeways that are consistently clogged, you know, night and day. So I'd be interested in your take on the level of investment that that LA has put into building out a transit system, particularly a fixed rail transit system in the metro, which is more expansive, at least in terms of ambition, than any other city in this, at least in the millennium, in this new millennium. So do you think they're going to make it to the ideal system by the Olympics? And what effect, more importantly, do you think it's already had on the way that the city is developed?
Well, this is a great question. Obviously, the situation has always been more complicated than people know. When I used to tell people, even in the 80s, ask them what was the largest public bus system in North America, the answer was Los Angeles, not New York City. And people were amazed by that. But there was always this enormous way that people who couldn't afford cars or didn't drive for one reason or another could get around, not necessarily as quickly as possible, but they could do it. And it is really how the factory workers and the housekeepers and the gardeners and folks like that used to, and still do, move around Los Angeles who don't own cars. Of course, in 1990, the city embarked and the region embarked on this massive effort. And that's the other trick question. It's not a question of the millennium. It is the largest mass transit build out in the United States since the completion of the IND subway in New York in 1940, which finished the 40 years that had begun around 1900. 40 years of furious construction that gave us the three systems, which then became, you know, the modern New York City subway system. But that, you know, kind of came to a close in around the time of World War II, and there were small additions made over the years, but nothing like what had happened before World War II. Meanwhile, in LA, starting fairly modestly, but with growing ambition and energy, they have been building this large rail system, basically, that it's kind of multiple forms of it. Some of it is bona fide underground rail, like a New York City subway. Some of it is light rail, we would call, like the Expo Line. It's not light rail because the cars are heavier, but it travels mostly on grade. And it's been adding year by year by year, and it's really become a kind of real presence in Los Angeles. Now, do most people still get around by cars on freeways? Of course. It is still, by far, that is the primary way that people move around Los Angeles. But it is now beginning to change the shape of the city. Curiously, not as much through its direct ridership, although its ridership is growing. And some of the lines that they've added, particularly the Expo Line to the beach, have proved wildly popular. I mean, it's become a thing now that young people, for example, who live on the west side of Los Angeles, who want to go to Santa Monica and to the beach, time their trip. They all get on the train together at the various stops, and they hang out, and they start having fun. I'm guessing they might be drinking beer or whatever. But in any case, the party starts on the Expo Line and makes its way to the beach. So that's become a part of teenage ritual in Los Angeles. If you had told me that in 1980 or 1990, I would have been amazed. But as I said, I don't think it's as much through the direct ridership on the line, as it's changing the way Los Angeles builds and builds its housing. It is leading to a dramatic densification of Los Angeles, where around the stations within about, you know, 2,000 feet, and you want to call 300, 400 meters, they are building very significantly multiple family dwellings, basically apartment houses and other kind of denser forms of, and higher rise often, forms of construction. So again, up and down the Expo Line, you see around every stop, you see these really significant developments. Now, they often also have garages, those developments. But they usually, it's a new way of life. People have one car instead of three. They can walk to some nearby places. They don't always have to take a car. They do take the train to places. And one imagines that as it becomes more and more the way of life of Los Angeles, you are seeing a shift in our understanding of LA. So that was one of the prompts of the book, which is that a new city is coming into being in the 21st century.
I really liked the time you also spent on the typology of the courtyard building, not least because I lived in just such a building, which the feeling that you described of the enclosure and the planting and the importance of the landscape is very accurate, even though the courtyard building I lived in, it faced west, and there was another building that was at least as high as across the street, so it didn't really get that much sun. But it was the whole idea of you open the gate, you walk in, and you're in a completely different place, but you're still within the urban milieu. And I liked the discourse that you started on that typology. And also a note, as you've been studying film and its relationship to cities, you talk about a number of movies which take place in these courtyard buildings or the bungalow courts. One that I noticed was missing that I thought was rather conspicuous was Mulholland Drive, where there's quite a racy scene that takes place in a bungalow court. And I was wondering how you went about your survey of films versus the bungalow courts versus the courtyard buildings, and how you narrowed down to the ones you wanted to talk about the most. Mm.
Well, that's another great question. We should say, to sort of contextualize this, that the book is broken down into three large parts. Part one is a kind of a general framing of the topic of mobility in Los Angeles. An epic topic, because after all, it was the shift from the sort of streetcar and boulevard world of pre-World War II. If you've all seen the movie Who's Afraid of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, that world of familiar world of Los Angeles before the war, which shifted over to the new model after World War II of the freeway and the tract house, and a city with no center, which became the model of 22nd half of the 20th century cities and into the 21st century cities all around the world. People look to Los Angeles as a vision of the future. So that's an epic story. The middle part of the book talks about the things we're just about to talk about, which is the relationship. It shifts over to a discussion about parking, and specifically parking and housing and their complex interrelationship. And the third part of the book, which we can talk about a little later, and which Greg alluded to, has to do with the advent of EVs and what they will mean for Los Angeles. But to go to the second part of the book, one of the points we make is that housing development in Los Angeles is shaped above all by parking. In fact, Francis Anderton, in conversation with me, said this, I won't say it's unintentionally hilarious, but it's hilarious because, James, you need to understand, in Los Angeles, parking drives everything. And it's true. And a man called Mark Valianatis, who's a brilliant planner, analyzes for us exactly how what had been a very rich array of housing types in Los Angeles in the 1920s and 30s, including these courtyard projects and bungalow projects, were basically forbidden or disallowed after World War II, simply because the parking requirements went up and there was just geometrically no way to fit the required amount of parking on the lot. But I've loved those projects. It sounds like you do too. They've mesmerized me for years. They're so magical. These are, to explain to listeners who might not quite know what we're talking about, these are basically developments. They're usually two or three stories tall. Sometimes they're one story tall. They're built on usually two or three suburban style lots. They're anywhere from 75 to 150 feet wide along the sidewalk, and they go about 150 feet deep into the lot, which is the standard size of an LA lot. But instead of having single family houses, they have a group of clustered apartments that fit around a central courtyard, and which are heavily, the courtyard itself and the sort of areas around it are heavily planted. And they all have individual entrances that open onto the courtyard. They're inspired by classical Moorish and Latin American courtyards that you might see in Spain or in Latin America, which themselves go back to, in fact, you know, Arab origination in centuries past. But they are small apartment complexes, basically. They do usually have some parking. When they were started, they had no parking. Then eventually, they usually had one off-street space per unit, which they tucked around the back or the side. And you walk into them and they're kind of magical environments. They usually have a little fountain trickling, the palms sway, you hear the laughter of children. You're in a sort of miniature paradise, a little Edenic slice of the magical environment of California, where if you give it a bit of water, anything will grow. So I became obsessed with those and decided to do their history. Now, I wasn't the first one. There was a brilliant book called Courtyard Housing in Los Angeles by Stefanos Palazoidas and his colleagues. It was done in the early 80s. And amazingly for that book, they hired Julius Shulman, the legendary photographer, whose work is always associated with mid-century modern houses. Everybody knows that famous shot taken at night, looking out over the Hollywood Hills in a modernist house, I think Craig Elwood House, with some fabulous women making cocktails in the back. Well, that's Julius Shulman, but in this case, he took pictures of these beautiful courtyards. So I really wanted to understand them, and yes, they appear in lots of films. Space permitted us only a certain number, so I think Mulholland Drive, maybe it was that we just couldn't find a still that we liked, because you have to capture the image in a still, but they, of course, are in Chinatown, they are in La La Land, they're in all kinds of films of every type, because, of course, they allow for the interaction among residents in a way that a single family house, it's hard to imagine, like you'd have to walk over to your neighbor's house and have some love affair with them. Not likely. But in a courtyard apartment where your apartment's kind of, you keep running into each other, more likely. So those were very popular. And then finally, and we can talk about this more, I decided to put on my architect hat. I am a registered architect in the state of New York, and design a new one, do a new modern version of them that would be built around modern apartment layouts. One of the things about the old ones from the 20s and 30s is that the apartments are from the 20s and 30s, and they're a little, by our standards, a little cranky. They have all sorts of funny kitchens and bathrooms that are not quite the way a modern house would be.
I could definitely testify to the veracity of that. Mine was split across two levels, one of which incorporated the old luggage room of what had originally been a hotel for aspiring young actresses. And so my front door was a swing door, two French doors, because it used to be the luggage room. And then you had to go up the stairs into the kitchen and then into a very small bedroom. But I loved it. You know, it was exactly as you described.
I just want to say the people who live in them wouldn't trade them for anything. They just love them. And they get along with one car to this day, and they make it work. And that's my argument. You could have a vision of Los Angeles in which houses each have one car. And if you have one car, designing one of these things is possible. You start getting to two or three cars and you simply can't do it. So.
Yeah, just the idea that a lot of these residences are literally now illegal to build is just apocryphal, considering the way that society has moved toward, you know, greener construction, greener energy, greener operations. You know, we still have these ridiculous parking restrictions. Do you think that there's any chance that we can whittle these things down over time? And it sounds like there's been a couple of major moves at the state level in California that have citywide implications in these cities, you know, such as San Jose and Los Angeles.
Yeah, city and state. Los Angeles was moved forward in the last two decades, really, with what they call transit-oriented communities. We would probably more likely call it transit-oriented development on the East Coast, but it's the same idea that you modify the zoning and land use and parking regulations for sites that are near transit and essentially make them much more flexible. You can build, you know, higher, denser, smaller setbacks on the zoning side. You can allow a kind of mixed use on the land use side, and you can have fewer or no parking spaces. And in the current TOD system, each station is kind of a bullseye, and I've forgotten the exact numbers, but something like within 1,000 feet, you don't have to have any parking at all. Now, does that mean that a developer wouldn't want to put some parking in? He might, or she might. They just don't have to. That's the rule. They can decide, and a big argument about this devolves to let the developer decide. They'll do market studies. They'll figure out what their tenants need and want, or their buyers, or whoever it's going to be, and let them figure out how much parking people want. And of course, with the key idea that by and large, young people are having fewer cars and using their cars less and do not want to pay for parking spaces whose construction they effectively have to subsidize that they're not going to use. And the developers are very alert to this. That, and after all, who buys most of these, you know, who are most of the buyers are people in their 20s or 30s, maybe early 40s. And they just see things, they see the world differently. Uber and Lyft have arrived, and they do not need to drive everywhere. And they might live on the metro, or they might even use the kind of Lyft or, you know, Lime or Bird or whatever types of things to scoot around the neighborhood to just get a, to get some groceries and so forth. So so that's a big thing, this kind of heavy-handed mandate that you must provide 2.4 parking spaces per every residential unit, hell or high water. That's what's really seriously being looked at. And now the state is the idea is that it should extend to all other kinds of communities, not just the big cities.
I want to jump in, James, can you also talk a bit about, as infrastructure changes, can you talk about the proposal there, the competition from pump to plug, looking at, as parking minimums change and as automobility declines, how it starts to change types of land use. In addition to California court, obviously Woods Bagot came up with several proposals of that. And I thought of it, I was this is where I get to toot my own horn again, as I was speaking a few weeks ago to the Southern California Association of Governments, which is adapting its own, you know, travel plan for long-term land use, but noted the fact that the proposals that you and Woods Bagot came up with very much mirror what Tesla is actually building. They're basically LED drive-in that has been in the works for a while and has now broken ground. So I do find it funny. I don't know if that's great minds thinking alike. Certainly great mind thought of it first and his mind is catching up to it. How do you imagine the gas station and those sites transforming and other potential typologies too? I mean, I'm sure you identified others.
Sure. Well, that was a big one, and that forms the, as I mentioned, sort of effectively part three of our book. Once we were involved in this and sort of word got out, and word in this case is often Greg Lindsay, we were approached by Christopher Hawthorne, who was the then chief design officer at the City of Los Angeles, who had developed his own idea for, it wasn't really a competition because there wasn't going to be a winner, but sort of ideas. I could call it competition, I suppose, ideas a project to invite architecture firms from all around the world to consider this a very impressive idea, I think, which is California, through Governor Newsom, has put into law that there will be no gasoline-powered cars sold in the state, or trucks sold in the state after 2035. And that will be that. And there will obviously still be some gas-powered cars on the road. But presumably, if that law stays in place, and it shows all signs of doing so, the number of gas-powered cars is going to be dramatically dropping and effectively be a fraction of what it is. And then a few years after that, there won't be any cars, gas-powered cars at all. So the question is, what happens to all those gas stations? There are 550 gas station sites in the city of Los Angeles. So that's not the region. I'm guessing it's probably three times that in the region. Now, just take the city, 550 sites, they're large. Everybody can imagine a gas station site. Everybody knows the frequent situation you see in Los Angeles, which is that one gas station is across the street from another gas station. And sometimes you have three, or I guess occasionally four, but most often two or three. They're prominent sites, they're on major streets. They're often at the intersection of two major streets, so they're sort of 100% locations in the real estate lingo. They're usually pretty large, they're usually about 150 feet by 150 feet, so that, which is to say they have the footprint of a very sizable lot that you could build an apartment house on or mixed-use development of various kinds. Obviously, there are remediation issues. They've been there for decades. The petroleum has been going into the ground for decades. In and around their tanks, but that would have to be resolved. But we know that electric charging does not require anything of the kind of land use commitment that gas stations do. I mean, when you think about it historically, the idea that you were going to take this incredibly flammable substance and have people put it in their cars in the middle of cities is a, yeah, why not have an explosive dump, you know, ammunition dump right there? It's virtually as dangerous. So, of course, it had to be separated by a great amount of space. It had to have all these protections and so forth. Well, electric chargers don't need any of that. You can put an electric charger in a garage of a house. You can put it in the garage of a apartment house, certainly. So we will not need to hand over huge plots of land, ultimately, for a gas station. What else could you do with them? First of all, where are they? What kind of places are they in? What kind of communities are they in? What kind of zoning commands those communities? So that's what one of the studies that Woods Bagot did with their brilliant design teams, data teams. And then the next one was, as an interim thing, well, chargers do take longer to charge than gas pumps take to pump. What could you imagine happening in a electric charging station that was also something else, where you could get a cup of coffee, have a store, maybe even watch a film or something like that? So we studied that as a design. Woods Bagot studied that as a design project, and that came up with some really fun and exciting ideas of what a mixed use charging station would be.
It also helps that, you know, the climate of LA, which people always point out, it's so ironic that people are so wedded to the car because it causes you to spend so much time indoors or inside a vehicle, when ideally it would be the perfect walking city because the weather is perfect all the time. The EV stations, that the design proposals that you talk about, start to get at this idea of, like, maybe we can still have a community around cars, because there's an important cultural element there that shouldn't be ignored and isn't ignored in your book, which is that although the automobile has been a destructive enabling device, let's say, for cities, it's also been a cultural touch point that has been really important for a lot of communities and has led to a lot of creativity. So I sort of feel like the idea of the EV station as an entertainment node, as a community center, as a place where you're going to need to spend a little bit of time, but it's going to be fun, might kind of find a way to gently nudge us out of, you know, gasoline car culture, but still kind of get at that, I don't know, I guess, for lack of a better term, the lowrider car culture that LA is also famous for.
Yeah, that's quite right. It's a couple of things to unpack there, I think, to start at the end. Yeah, I mean, no other city in the world has kind of cherished its cars and made a culture of cars quite like Los Angeles, and that's something we were very alert to. And as you point out, it's very often otherwise marginalized communities that have done so. And so that in the last project I was describing, we talk about, you know, how important car culture has been for Latino culture, for example. There are also uses. It's hard for an Easterner to get their head around the idea of, like, how important, like, the car meetup is in LA, where a parking lot is turned into a communal space where people bring their vintage cars or their souped up cars or their high performance cars or whatever. And it's just a wonderful thing to do in the afternoon, and people bring their families and it's free and everybody shows off their car. And then they do these little racing things sometimes. So that's real and authentic and a real piece of community, and we wanted to be alert to that. And we talked about that could be a component of this EV project, including giant screens where you could then kind of show everybody, you know, details of your car and so forth. So that's a real thing. On the other side, as Greg points out in his chapter, you know, something like what you have in Santa Monica, where the rise of the sort of tech-enabled scooter, the e-scooter that can be left on the sidewalk, picked up, taken somewhere for a few blocks, left again, you know, is really works in LA in a place like Santa Monica, in part because of the climate. You can do it. It so rarely rains that it's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. There are obviously some issues, and they've been trying to be addressed about strewing the scooters all over the sidewalk, and now that's they're making some headway on that. But but that idea that you could uncouple all the multiple things that we put into a single car, the idea of the four-wheeled passenger vehicle, and Greg's chapter is kind of brilliant at looking at actually it's good for some things, not good for other things. We could find other ways of getting around. And among those we talk about is we have three very provocative maps, which are catchment maps. And one shows the catchment of the metro system in LA, which is to say everything within certain walking distances, a 5-minute walk, a 10-minute walk. We have the same for the bus system. But then what we did was we took the metro map and we added to it an Uber catchment of a 7-minute car ride, $7 Uber ride, with the idea that a big problem of Los Angeles with the metro is the so-called last mile problem, which is that when you get out, maybe you're on one side, you're at your office in downtown LA or Century City or somewhere like that, but when you get out to your residential area, you may have too long a walk ahead of you. But what if you could just take the Uber for that short little piece just to get you to the station, make the long haul across town on the train, and save some money and avoid traffic along the way? So that's it. It turns out that map, the Uber plus, you know, plus Metro map, covers most of Los Angeles.
Well, I think the practical question that I would want to ask is just, okay, so these speculations are very convincing, and the data that you put together about how much parking could be replaced by housing and how much redevelopment could occur on the site of what are now currently gas stations, you know, appear to have a pretty solid basis. And you were pretty conservative too. I mean, you were looking at mostly off-street parking conversions, not taking away parking that's already in parking lanes, although there's some discussion of how those could be reconfigured, of course, which we've already seen with, you know, changes to the streetscape in COVID times. How receptive have developers been to these ideas? I mean, have you been taking this on the road to developers? I mean, what's been the audience? What's been the reception to this?
Well, we've started that process. You know, this is actually what you're referring to is what the original core study was that this whole book really emerged from. And I kind of missed a beat in telling the story of how the book happened, which was that in 2018, we were asked by John Rassant, who some of your listeners may know, who is the founder of Commotion LA. It was his second year of doing Commotion. And he said, hey, we'd love you to have a workshop if you're interested in these kinds of things. And Nick Corrales, who's the CEO of Woods Bagot, and along with his team and me, came up with the idea of rethinking parking space in Los Angeles. But we wanted to be really rigorous about it. And you often hear this loose statistic that 200 square miles of space is devoted to parking in Los Angeles. Well, it's a great factoid, and it's true, but it's kind of useless. So what? So okay, a lot of space. What we thought was the important question is how much developable space is handed over to parking. So we ruled out parking garages above grade. We ruled out parking garages below grade. Either of them would be way too expensive to build on. You'd have to tear down what you have. We ruled out curbside parking spaces because you can't build a building on a 10-foot wide, 20-foot long parking space. We ruled out lots that were smaller than 5,000 square feet, so were not really suitable for large scale any kind of major development. And we ruled out parking associated with industrial sites, factory parking lots and that sort of thing, because that's a delicate topic and you don't want to do things that might impact the sort of blue collar employment base of the city. And then we went to work. So what we're talking about is on grade parking lots that you could build on tomorrow. Where are they? How much space is there? And so forth. And we analyzed, when I say we, I again mean the data teams at Woods Bagot, analyzed those sites. We drew a circle around the middle of Los Angeles because there's another complication of LA. The county of Los Angeles is the largest county just about in the country. It's 4,000 square miles. It has miles of desert and national parks and places where the issue of parking is not a problem. The city of Los Angeles is a funny cut up piece of cheese with these little strips and stripes and big holes in the middle of it, like most people on the East may not know that Santa Monica, for example, and West Hollywood and Culver City are not part of the city of Los Angeles, even though they're sitting right in the middle of the city of Los Angeles. So we made our own nice, gentle, big, contiguous circle around what's basically the LA Basin. And in that space, we found 25.4 square miles, mind you, of parking lots. That's bigger than the island of Manhattan, of parking lots that you could build on tomorrow in that big central area of Los Angeles. And so that was kind of astonishing. And then we went the extra mile to go, well, what could you build on them? And here again, we were very conservative. We're not going to put skyscrapers in a single family neighborhood. That's never going to happen. So we followed the local zoning. We only built to the max of what the surrounding zoning was. And with that, we found these astonishing numbers. If you were to build every one of them out, you could house something like 1.4 million extra people. Obviously, that's not likely to happen anytime soon. But even a one-quarter build-out would be housing for 400,000 people, which is to say, take care of LA's growth needs for, you know, easily 10, but more likely 20 years to come. We are showing it to developers and talking to them, and we certainly talked to developers while we did it. I had a number of conversations with developers, and that's where I heard again and again that they are the biggest proponents of changing those stupid parking rules, because they don't want to have to build parking that they don't think their tenants are going to need, because it's expensive. Building a piece of structured parking is like $85,000. So why not take that money and put it into the unit, or build two more units? You know, if you have two of those spaces, you could build a studio apartment just about. So they're really pushing for that, changes of those rules.
Well, I really am excited to see how the ideas that are contained within this volume start to manifest in reality. It kind of seems like the regulatory and the development environment is finally keeping pace with the ideas that people have had for many, many years. And I commend you for bringing this together. So the book is called Renewing the Dream, The Mobility Revolution and the Future of Los Angeles. There will be a reading, I believe, at Book Soup in the city of West Hollywood, not in Los Angeles, on the 5th of January. And then I believe at the Skyscraper Museum in New York City on the 12th.
I think it's the 23rd. I should get that down. We're exactly right.
Check your local listings.
Yeah, check your local listings. And we're doing it. It's actually a conversation on the 5th that I'll be doing with Francis Anderton and Donald Shoup. So a real Twilight of the Gods kind of meeting there. And at Book Soup at 7 p.m. On Friday the 5th. It's free and no RSVP necessary. So if you're in the neighborhood, I want to have a really great conversation with three people who have thought a lot about it. Frances herself has written a book recently about housing in Los Angeles, and Donald, of course, knows more about parking than anybody in the world. And I think it'll be a great chat. And then Skyscraper Museum in January. Take a look at the Skyscraper Museum website. We'll go from there.
Phenomenal. Thank you, James.
Thank you. Did you not alone?